The headlines: a British court issues an order to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the U.S. to face trial for publishing classified files related to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Israeli settlers with the protection of the military storm into Al-Aqsa Mosque for a fourth consecutive day and infuriate Palestinians by desecrating the holy site. And the battle for control of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol nearing a crucial stage, with a besieged officer warning that the city could fall within hours. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour: UK court has formally ordered to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States to face trial for publishing classified documents. After a hearing, the court in central London subsequently sent its order to the Home Secretary to rubber stamp Assange's transfer. According to the court order, Assange can appeal within 14 days of any decision to approve the extradition. Last month, he was denied permission to appeal to the UK Supreme Court. Washington wants to put him on trial in connection with publication of about 500,000 confidential military files in 2010. They revealed how US-led forces killed civilians in unreported incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan. Assange, who was already denied any wrongdoing, could face a lifetime in prison. He's been in a southeast London jail since 2019 after Ecuador's government revoked his asylum at its embassy in Britain. The situation is very tense in the occupied Al-Quds. For a fourth consecutive day, Israeli settlers, accompanied and protected by military forces, have stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They've attacked Palestinian worshippers inside the compound, all in the name of observing the Jewish holiday of Passover. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kendall gives us a wrap-up of what happened.
Well, for the fourth consecutive day, Israeli forces raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque and try to force Palestinian settlers out of the holy site in order to allow Israeli settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. We have to remind that Jewish Israelis are celebrating one of their feasts known as Passover that will continue until the 24th of this month. And part of celebrating this feast would be Israeli settlers raiding and storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and touring inside it. They consider it as normal visits, but for Muslims, of course, they are desecrating the Muslim holy site. Many of the Palestinian worshippers were locked in the Qibli Mosque, one of the mosques of the Al-Aqsa, and now we are receiving that Israeli police officers have even fired rubber-coated bullets toward the Palestinian protesters, Palestinian worshippers, who were demanding the Israeli settlers to go out and not to desecrate their holy site. Let's say up till the moment, dozens of Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex under the protection of Israeli forces, of course, who continue to attack the Palestinian Muslims.
It's day 56 of the war in Ukraine. Fighting continues over the control of Mariupol, with Russian forces now very close to fully capturing the strategic port city. Ukraine says it has reached a preliminary agreement with Russia to open a humanitarian corridor for women, children, and elderly people out of the besieged city. But thousands of Ukrainian troops and civilians remain holed up at a steel plant in Mariupol. A commander has pleaded for help from inside the factory, saying his forces are facing their last days, if not hours. He said in a Facebook post that his troops are largely outnumbered. Moscow had given foreign and Ukrainian troops still fighting in Mariupol a Wednesday deadline of 11 hours GMT, saying that their lives would be spared if they laid down their arms and surrendered. And the Pentagon says the West is intensifying its military support for Ukraine.
I would just say, without getting into what other nations are providing, that they have received additional platforms and parts to be able to increase their fleet size, their aircraft fleet size. Thank God.
Kirby noted that Ukraine's partners are also offering spare parts to help Kiev repair its damaged arsenal. He refused to give details about Washington's aid package, citing security concerns. But according to other U.S. officials, the package is going to be nearly the same size as the $800 million aid that Washington announced last week. Russian-made helicopters that had once been intended for Afghanistan are reportedly included in that package. Norway also says it will be donating 100 Mistral air defense missiles to Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky has been calling for more military support from Western supporters. Finland's parliament will shortly start debating a decision to apply for NATO membership, with the issue gaining more political and public support, mainly because of the war in Ukraine. The government is hoping to reach a parliamentary consensus within weeks. At least half of Finland's 200 lawmakers are now supporting a NATO membership. Also, opinion polls indicate that over 60% of the public are in favor of the move. Neighboring Sweden is also discussing a membership bid. A recent poll shows 57% of Swedes approve of joining the alliance, but Russia strongly opposed to NATO's eastward expansion. Russia has previously warned Finland and Sweden against joining the alliance, saying that could result in a nuclear buildup in the Baltic.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month, if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We're going to go back to our top story for this half hour, where UK court is formally ordered to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US to face trial for publishing classified documents. Robert Carter joins us now from the British capital, London. Robert, what more can you tell us about this court ruling, and what is to become of Julian Assange when he does touch down in the US?
Well, obviously, this court ruling isn't the final stage in the decision-making process. What's going to happen now is Home Secretary Priti Patel will be the one that signs off on the extradition, so she will have the final say on this. That's why WikiLeaks has reissued a fresh call for its supporters and the supporters of Julian Assange to not give up the fight just yet. The pressure needs to be amplified in order to try and reach out to the Home Secretary's good nature, if you like, whether or not she'll rule in favor of keeping Assange here or rule in favor of the US and ship him over there. That's the big question. And of course, Priti Patel has a reputation actually for basically trying to ship as many people out of the UK as she possibly can. I'm of course referring to the immigration or the refugee policy that she's been spearheading, very controversial policies such as the Nationality and Borders Bill, which we've covered here extensively, where essentially she just wants to kick out anyone that the UK doesn't want here and ship them over to places like Rwanda. So when it comes to Julian Assange, it's a unique case. This is an attack on journalistic freedoms, and it also just shows how unwilling the UK is to defend journalists' rights to report very vital information, which is of key interest to the public. So Julian Assange has a lot of backing from the public, from other journalists, and even from some politicians as well. But so far, all of that support has not been enough to save him from the process, which is slowly but surely moving its way closer towards that extradition, where he faces 175 years incarceration in US jails. And of course, once again, the US is not known for having the most good quality human rights abiding legal and prison system, as we even know from our dear presenter who was wrongly incarcerated herself, Marzia Hashemi, I'm referring to, when she went over to the US.
All right, thanks a lot, Robert. Robert Carter joining us from the British capital, London. Moving on, a pivotal moment in the race for the Elysee Palace. Incumbent President Emmanuel Macron and his far-right contender Marine Le Pen will face off at a televised debate later today. The crucial debate will be the only direct clash between the two candidates out of Sunday's second-round vote. Some polls are projecting that Macron has a 10-point lead over Le Pen in the runoff. Still, undecided voters and abstentions could swing the figures, rather. Macron won more votes than Le Pen in the first round 10 days ago, but failed to get the 50% needed for his re-election. The two contenders are getting prepared for a rematch of the 2017 race, but this year, the gap is much smaller. And we've reached out to our correspondent in Paris, Chris Den Haunt, to talk about some of the issues that the two contenders might bring up to attack one another in the upcoming debate. Let's take a listen.
One of the issues of the debate this evening for Macron will be to attack Le Pen on her openly racist issues. And Marine Le Pen will certainly attack Macron on his anti-social issues, because she is adapting a kind of social discourse, which is absolutely not coherent with her program. So people who did not vote in the first round, not for Macron and not for Le Pen, they are hesitating. A part of them will not vote for Macron and Le Pen in the second round, but an important part of them, and that's why the gap between both candidates has risen to more than almost 10 points. So an important part of the popular communities, and also the Muslim community in France, they say that if Marine Le Pen becomes president, it will be a very openly racist, anti-Muslim, violent president with the program against women's rights.
In Malaysia, the search continues for scores of Myanmarese Rohingya migrants who are at large following a dramatic escape from a temporary detention center. Malaysian authorities say they've recaptured most of the 500-plus detainees who broke out of the center early this morning. Six of those on the run, including a young girl and a boy, lost their lives while crossing a highway. The breakout was reportedly triggered by protests at the detention center. Malaysia is a key destination for migrants fleeing violence in Myanmar. Thousands of Rohingya Muslims were killed, raped, tortured, or arrested during a military crackdown 5 years ago. Buddhist-majority Myanmar does not recognize the minority as its citizens. And China is reporting more deaths from COVID in its biggest city, where authorities are trying hard to stem the spread of the virus. The new deaths in Shanghai bring the total to 17 in the latest major outbreak since 2020. Hundreds of thousands of new cases have also been detected in the city, where only 38% of residents over 60 are fully vaccinated. Since late March, the financial hub has been under a tight lockdown to combat the outbreak that's being blamed on the Omicron variant. China has also imposed lockdowns on other cities that are seeing a fresh surge in infections. Since the start of the UN-brokered truce in Yemen, On the 2nd of April, Saudi Arabia has not opened the Sana'a International Airport. Observers describe the Saudi move as a threat to the political process in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
In a Twitter post, the head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said since the entry of the UN brokered truce, the Saudi-led coalition has prevented flights from reaching the Sana'a International Airport and obstructed the entry of fuel ships to the port of Hodeidah.
We have entered the third week of the truce while Sana'a Airport has not been opened yet, as it was supposed. Unfortunately, no commercial flight has arrived, even though the airport is technically ready. We do not know what are the reasons that prevent the opening of the airport until now, but what we do know is that the Saudi-led coalition has not adhered to any agreements since the start of its war on our country in 2015.
Observers say the Saudi violations are threatening the UN brokered agreement, which is supposed to build for a comprehensive political solution. They are calling on the United Nations to intervene and open Sana'a Airport.
The Saudi-led coalition engineered this truce to rearrange its ranks and to restore the new coalition headed by the United States of America. Today, there is an American presence in the Red Sea, so I believe that the naval battle will return and the Saudi-led coalition will not do its part of the truce that establishes a political solution that ends the war. The United Nations must intervene and open Sana'a Airport, as it is the mediator in this agreement.
In the beginning of April, the UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, announced a two-month truce. The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for two flights per week and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hodeidah Port.
For 7 years of war and siege, the United Nations has always been providing the political cover-up for Saudi Arabia's violations of international law. But now that it has brokered an agreement, it should take real measures to force Riyadh to do its part of the truce and open Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's capital, Tehran, is hosting the International Quran Exhibition. The event is held every year during the fasting month of Ramadan to showcase the latest Quranic products from across the Muslim world. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Russian military operation in Ukraine has captured the attention of the world, and the Western powers are arming, funding, and providing political and humanitarian support for the Ukrainians. Meanwhile, Palestine has slipped off the global agenda, and besieged, blockaded, and bombed Gaza has become invisible. Dear listeners, we now present you an article in this regard written by Michael Jensen, a political commentator. The piece is titled, "The Zionist Regime Setting Gazans Adrift from National Identity and Nullifying Their Claim to Palestine." Please stay tuned. On February 23rd, the day before the Russian operation in Ukraine, Al-Haq, the Palestinian human rights organization, released a report entitled Cultural Apartheid, Israel's Erasure of Palestinian Heritage in Gaza. The report is based on an investigation by Forensic Architecture, a research organization based in London, which managed to virtually reconstruct key ancient sites in the Israeli-occupied and bombarded Gaza Strip. Al-Haq and Forensic Architecture accused the Zionist regime of using strategic strikes to erase Gaza's rich cultural heritage, thereby denying Palestinians, as Al-Haq put it, the right to self-determination over their cultural resources, and by extension, threatens their existence as a people. Around 12,000 archaeological sites have been surveyed in the Palestinian territories since 1967 Israeli regime occupation. Three West Bank Palestinian sites have been chosen for UNESCO's World Heritage List: the Church of Nativity in Beit Lahm, the Old City of Al-Khalil, and the cultural landscape of northern Al-Quds around the village of Batir. UNESCO dubbed the latter Palestine Land of Olives and Vines, as the hills around Batir is terraced for olive orchards and vegetable gardens, which are watered by traditional underground networks. Since the Old City in Al-Quds and its walls are disrupted, UNESCO has not assigned them to either Palestine or the regime of Israel. The State of Palestine has submitted three sites in Gaza to UNESCO for consideration. Situated near Al-Shati refugee camp, Antidon Harbor is the oldest known port on Gaza Mediterranean coast. Antidon Harbor, which was seriously damaged during the Zionist regime's 2021 bombing of Gaza, was inhabited between 800 BC to 1100 AD and served as a major trading hub on the commercial route between Europe and the Levant. The ancient Roman settlement of Tel Omer, the birthplace of Saint Hilarion near Al-Nusayrat village on Gaza coast. The settlement was located on the road connecting Mesopotamia to Egypt. One of the most important coastal wetlands on the eastern Mediterranean is Wadi Gaza, which stretches 105 kilometers from the Negev Hills and the southern Al-Khalil Heights to the East Gaza and follows a circuitous route for 7 kilometers through Gaza. The wetlands are not only rich in diversity of flora and fauna, but also a staging area for migratory birds. These sites delve deep into Gaza's history as a land bridge between Egypt and Mesopotamia, Iraq and the Levant, and on the continental scale between Africa and West Asia. Gaza was a crossroads of multiple civilizations: Egyptian, Greek, Mesopotamian, Persian, and Arab, to name the key empires which impacted on this narrow coastal strip until the Zionist regime occupied the lands, imprisoned Palestinians, and halted traffic along the Palestinian coast. During its 1948-49 war, the regime of Israel drove the inhabitants from cities, towns, and villages into Gaza, where refugees now count for 70% of the Strip's 2.1 million people. The destructive impact of this influx and long-term presence on Gaza's rich cultural heritage cannot be calculated. Contractors building housing, infrastructure, and manufacturing plants have both destroyed heritage sites and made extensive collections of ancient Greek pottery, coins, and Islamic relics, while fishermen and swimmers continue to discover and sell antiquities washed onto beaches or dredged up from the sea. In 2008, builder Jawad Qudri opened a one-room museum called Al-Mawaf to display some of his treasures. Located off the coast near the Shati refugee camp, Almodov welcomes busloads of school children who have little knowledge of the long history of their beleaguered and impoverished. In January 2009, Almodov was struck by shrapnel and pottery smashed when the Israeli regime bombed a nearby sports field during its 2008 to 2009 attack on Gaza. A second museum has been opened at Al-Gharara, an ancient site south of Gaza City by Muhammad and Najla Abu Lahia. The collection features artifacts from 4000 BC through the Roman, Byzantine, early Islamic, and Ottoman empires, and includes wooden plows, horse saddles, baskets, and items used half a century ago. During Israeli regime's 2014 offensive, Al-Haq reported the destruction of 61 and damage to 120 mosques and partial damage to a church. During the May 2021, the Israeli regime assault, both ancient and modern and heritage sites were targeted or indirectly damaged due to bombing of nearby areas as well as 124 places of worship. Among the sites struck were the Great Umari Mosque, the second oldest in Palestine, the Kitab al-Walaya Mosque, the historic Church of St. Porphyrius, and Tal Amr, and the ruins of St. Hilarion Monastery. Al-Haq has called on the International Criminal Court to initiate prosecutions of the Zionist regime for targeting cultural property as this fundamentally affects the core of Palestinians' identity and their existence as people and constitutes a crime against humanity. Furthermore, destruction of cultural heritage, which takes place under an illegal apartheid regime, is also a crime against humanity. By destroying Palestinian connections to their land, the civilizations which have ruled Gaza and its distinctive culture, the regime of Israel seeks to set Gazans adrift from their national identity and nullify their claim to Palestine. This is what Daesh tried to do so by devastating the heritage of Syria and Iraq with the aim of destroying the millennial identities of Syrians and Iraqis so they would submit to the outfit harsh, uncivilized regime.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we're discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are presently focusing on the third sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the wisdom behind his leadership, his governance, and what are those reasons why he took over why he took the government in his hands and what he was planning to do. And how lucky we are that tonight we are trying to gather some understanding regarding this great personality and his views and his way of thinking, especially considering that tomorrow is the 19th day of the holy month of Ramadan, based on certain accounts and based on certain calendars. And of course, the night before the day, the 19th day, is one of the nights of Qadr, and also is the night where Imam Ali alayhi salam was struck by the sword. And therefore, it is very much important for us to bring our hearts towards this reality and to try our best to attend the programs that are there that remind us about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His power and the Quran and the duties that we have with regards to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, especially Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Ya laylatal qadri ya fawwa barina khayrun min ad-dahri bil afwi tatina.
Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters. We are continuing our discussion on the wisdom behind Imam Ali alayhi salam taking up the governance of the Islamic Ummah at the very crucial time that he took. So the question that we were trying to understand is that was Imam Ali alayhi salam really allowed and permitted by the people? Did the people give him that freedom to be able to apply those things that he had in his mind, those aims and objectives that he deeply felt with his heart that required the Ummah to achieve? Was he allowed to allow them? Was he allowed to, promote that type of thought that he had in mind? Unfortunately, the answer is very difficult to consider, but we can say shortly that he wasn't fully able to do that because of the restrictions and because of the constrictions that he faced from the people. Of course, he had the power to be able to maybe, force people and maybe cause certain movements that were, very rash. But he always used his wisdom to bring the people slowly on board. But unfortunately, there were people who did not allow this to happen. Did they allow this bright sun of guidance to shed its light on different aspects of the people's lives so that those different entities would be able to achieve their aims and objectives? Or were there people that continued to cover themselves from the light, just like, bats that hated light and just confined themselves in their darknesses and stopped even others from reaching their aims and objectives? It seems like, yes, there was a group of people like that who did not allow Imam Ali alayhi salam to go ahead and to perform what he needed. And who are these people? And what types of people were these, inshallah, we will discuss in the coming segment.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters. We want to find out which groups of people were not able to bear the light that Imam Ali alayhi salam was trying to emanate and give to the people. Who are these people? Were they just people who loved the world? Were they people that had some crooked ways of thinking? Were they people whose hearts were sealed because of their sins? Which groups of people were these? Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this sermon, with his enchanting eloquent words and statements, and by those step by step explanations that he gives in this sermon, he clearly draws out that picture that depicts these different groups who came about and contradicted the methodology that Imam Ali alayhi salam was trying to apply in the society. The surprising thing is that Imam Ali alayhi salam, whatever he tried to explain and to tell these people, and what he tried to, create in the society, is so deep, is so, so requires so much pondering and so much thinking, that if we were to explain these things in words, it would take us ages. But Imam Ali alayhi salam explains them in very simple, clear, and very, concise, in a very concise manner. But if someone were to think about those words, it's like very deep, and it requires a lot of pondering and thinking, and to kind of open up the whole thing that he has explained. So we are trying to, inshallah, see from this sermon what Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to tell us with regards to which groups of people and what type of thinking they had that led to not being able to benefit from the methods that Imam Ali alayhi salam had in mind. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
in the limelight.
In England, 2 in 5 people believe that democracy is not working, citing a loss of trust and corruption as the biggest factors. Only 28% trust the national government to look after their interest. Polling in Scotland and Northern Ireland records similarly dismal levels of confidence in the UK executive. Here we present you an article in this regard, written by Moya Lotion MacLean, a journalist who writes about politics and digital culture, titled, "Offshoring in Rwanda isn't a dead cat to distract from Party 8. It's just plain inhumane." Please stay with us to hear more about this story. In British politics, nothing is as it seems, apparently. Barely had news of the Home Office's draconian immigration deal with Rwanda broken on Thursday, April 14th, when it began to be proclaimed a political diversion. Journalists and MPs alike invoked the tired image of a dead cat, the phrase associated with the strategist Linton Crosby, to describe the act of willfully talking up one hot-button issue to divert attention from another. Members of the public took to social media to agree that, yes, the plan to process certain asylum seekers in offshore centers thousands of miles away was indeed just an attempt to push Partygate off the front pages. Except, this explanation doesn't really tally. Attempts to outsource asylum applications have been in the works for nearly 3 years. Negotiations with Rwanda reportedly took place over 8 months. The plan forms a key part of the breathtakingly inhumane plank of immigration policies the Home Secretary Priti Patel is introducing, a cruel and illegal attempt to make an already hostile environment completely unlivable. So why the conviction that this latest proposal hardly shifting criticism away from Boris Johnson, who took ownership of the policy, is not a means to an end, but a smokescreen to shield him? The specter of the dead cat has been everywhere during Johnson's tenure as Prime Minister. Writing in 2019, the historian Charlotte Lydia Riley implored commentators to cease proclaiming every political happenstance to be a dead cat. She wrote, "The idea that there must be a clever plan behind political campaigns also shows our desire to believe that there is someone somewhere in control," adding, "But in truth, politics is messy. Nobody is in control. The world is not governed by clever people doing clever things." But this paranoid style has only grown, cultivated during the Brexit and Trump years. It is now a mainstay of political conversation. Where is it coming from? A lack of trust is one obvious answer. Westminster is viewed with suspicion across the Union. In England, 2 in 5 people believe that democracy is not working, citing a loss of trust and corruption as the biggest factors. While the Welsh electorate still have faith in their beloved parliament, only 28% trust the national government to look after their interests. Polling in Scotland and Northern Ireland records similarly dismal levels of confidence in the UK executive. The public is also increasingly skeptical of the journalists charged with reflecting the world back at them. Despite a pandemic-induced boost, overall trust in wider UK news reporting only comes in at 36%, 14 percentage points lower than before 2016's Brexit referendum. While this is not quite a full-blown crisis in faith, It speaks to that broader miasma of distrust that has rolled over the land in the past 5 years. Many people don't know quite what or who to believe anymore, as the political identities and givens that previously anchored them have turned to sand beneath their feet. Moya Lotian MacLean wrote, "And so they turn to conspirational thinking. By this, I don't mean people across Britain are signing up to full-blown conspiracy theories about vaccines and moon landings, but rather that we increasingly defer to a knowing cynicism about the world, which always assumes the real meaning of political events is hidden. Rwanda deportation plans are a dead cat. Tighter COVID-19 rules are a diversion. No, wait, relaxed COVID-19 rules are the real trick mirror. All of these things, slightly feverishly suspicious as they are, sound as if they could be true, but often a little digging suggests they are not." Lotian MacLean said, "Of course, the problem is that there are dead cats flung on to the table every so often. Take Johnson desperately trying to deflect from Partygate scrutiny by repeating a discredited claim linking Keir Starmer to Jimmy Savile. A healthy dose of cynicism and critical thinking never goes amiss when analyzing the political landscape. But this rising tendency of fearful mistrust paired with alternative, often ill-informed explanations concerns me." MacLean added, "If you are politically homeless, a term we despise but is increasingly used, then anything goes. Partly, membership can be grounding, fostering connections and communities and orienting people towards shared political goals. Research suggests that partisanship limits exactly which conspirational narratives are to be believed. What then happens when traditional alignments are replaced with political identities that are issue-based? Add in a shocking lack of political education, a climate of fear stoked by media and politicians alike, and the disappearance of independent local media, and you can see how many of the public have now been left to cobble together their own hodgepodge understanding of the inner workings of the institutions that govern their lives. The results are a suitably misshamed and jaded interpretation of events." Why does this matter? Because the stronger the tendency towards conspirational accounts of everything, the more likely a worsening of the social ills that cause disaffection in the first place. Political distrust and conspirational thinking lead to nihilism and apathy. Successive studies have found that full-blown conspirational beliefs positively correlate with political disengagement, more belligerent attitudes to human rights and civil liberties, and less civic participation, such as voting, donating, and volunteering. Even diluted conspirational thinking has a negative impact. Repeatedly, it's shown that those who are less trusting are more disconnected from politics, the news around them, and general society. Lotian MacLean wrote, "I have seen firsthand how a loss of faith saps energy and produces a bitter political indifference. Clearly, simply entreating people to realign with concrete political organizations isn't the solution to restore trust or how democracy works. Hoping that national politics will clean itself up on its own doesn't seem likely either. One more. The answer is probably frustratingly pick and mix. Political education, reminding yourself that sometimes incompetence is a more likely explanation than some clever scheme, getting involved locally with a cause that channels vague resentment into positive politics, a multi-pronged approach. MacLean concluded, conspirational thinking is easy enough to understand, but we need to resist inventing shadowy new monsters to slay. The ones we already have are dangerous enough.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful hadith and narration, which has been narrated from the Holy Prophet regarding the mosque and maintaining the mosques. As you know, we are in the month of Ramadan, and in a lot of Muslim countries, tonight is the night of Qadr, the first of the nights of Qadr, in which we go to the mosque, the masajid, and we worship Allah and we ask forgiveness for Him. And it's a very important night. All of what is going to transpire in the rest of the year for us is written down in this night. You know, our actions that we performed in the year prior to this, they are presented before the living Imam, Imam Zaman alayhi wasalam. A lot of things happen in this night. It's a very important night, and it's recommended to pray in this night, make dua in this night, ask forgiveness for our sins that we've made in the previous year. So we would like to ask our readers to please remember us here at Hadith of the Day and IRB English Radio on this night. Let's look at what the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said regarding the maintenance of the mosque. This is very important, you know, for the people who are taking care of the mosque, the caretakers of the mosque. This is very important because we need to maintain the mosque for the worshippers who are going to come tonight and worship Allah in this night. This is part of ibadah in this blessed month, right? Let's begin by first reciting a verse of the Holy Quran. In the Holy Quran, we read, only those who maintain Allah's mosques, who believe in Allah and the last day, and establish prayer and give the zakat, and fear no one except Allah, they hopefully will be among the guided. Here in this verse, Allah Ta'ala mentions some of the conditions for those who want to maintain the mosque. Faith in Allah, faith in the hereafter, the establishment of prayer, and the giving of zakat. In this beautiful hadith, the Prophet Muhammad was once asked by Abu Dhar how to maintain the mosque. To this he replied in the following way, voices should not be raised therein, nor engrossment in wrongdoing. There should be no buying or selling in the mosque, and all vain talk must be shunned as long as you are inside. You know, this is very important. A lot of times in the month of Ramadan, or especially in the nights of Qadr, when we take off from work or take off from school, you know, to stay in the mosque, right? We come there with the intention of doing ibadat, but we end up talking about this and that, you know, unnecessary things. Because, you know, a lot of times in people, especially people who are in non-Muslim countries, these are the kind of nights where we, you know, end up meeting our Muslim friends after a long time, you know, and then we want to catch up with one another, what's going on in your life and this and that, right? We start doing this and we forget about why, the reason why we actually came to the mosque. So this hadith of the Prophet is kind of instructive for us. It can help us, you know, avoid, you know, this problem. In continuation, the Prophet said, if you do not do this, then you will have no one to blame but yourself on the Day of Resurrection. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the maintenance of the mosque in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.